Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WMYC app, our website at WMYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon. Just after 3 p.m. yesterday, Hillary Rodham Clinton announced that she would seek the presidency in 2016. As the New York Times reports today, if successful, she would become the first female nominee from either party with a serious chance to become the first woman to be elected president. This historic step for women could not have been achieved without the efforts and activism of countless women who wage battles for things like the right to vote, the right to own property, to hold office, and to sit on juries. Cokie Roberts has written an account of some of the remarkable women who played essential behind-the-scenes roles in the 19th century in a book called Capital Dames, The Civil War and the Women of Washington, 1848-1868. It's published by Harper, and I'm very pleased it has brought her back to our show.
Welcome so nice
back.
To see you.
You've made it a special mission to write about women in politics, and you've spent your entire life surrounded by it.
Entire life, right?
So how much have things changed during those years?
Well, huge amounts changed in the years since I was a kid, growing up in Washington and seeing politics very much as a man's game. But what hasn't,
because your father was in Congress,
father
but
was
then
in
your
Congress,
mother was in Congress.
And then my mother was in Congress. What hasn't changed is the tremendous influence that these women had even before they had the official roles. And I have really enjoyed learning about and teaching about the women of the Revolutionary period and the early Republic. And
that, so this is a natural outgrowth of
well,
that
Well, it kind
thinking?
Of is. I mean, there's a missing period between 1824 and 1848.
Although there are a couple of women here who go back.
But that's right. That's right. I mean, I was yesterday, Leonard, at my aunt's 100th birthday in Mississippi, which was just so wonderful. And she's completely with it. And she kept talking about what she has seen in 100 years of life. And one of my cousins pointed out to her, well, actually, it's even more than 100 years because you carry the memories of your parents from the 19th century, you know? And so that's true about these women. They carry history from an earlier period. But the Civil War, as you know, we're right now today in that little tiny period between Appomattox and the assassination of Lincoln, when the North, at least, was rejoicing so much, particularly the city of Washington. And the Civil War is just something that we have been fascinated about as a country, and we are commemorating the 150th anniversary. So that's why I chose this period.
But I was also thinking about the two women that you begin the book with in 1848, two political widows, mm-hmm. Eliza Hamilton, who was then 90, and Dolly Madison, who was 80. Were they still active in politics?
Well, Dolly Madison was. Eliza Hamilton was 90, and 90 is old now, and it was really old then. But she was visited as a personage. But Dolly Madison was very active, and she was someone who advised and counseled politicians. They all came to her. The foreign heads of state, when they would come to Washington, would call on her. She was first lady for about a half a century.
The occasion for the outing between them was to begin the building of the Washington Monument, and you write that this moment was one of the last in which the country was united. Hadn't the defeat of Mexico and addition of new territories upset the balance of slave-owning state and abolitionist states and thrown everything out of whack?
Well, that this was as that was happening, mm-hmm. right? And so you had the newspapers of the time saying, you know, it just shows you that people can remember the times when we were united, but it hadn't yet fallen apart. The debates of the 1850s are really what made it fall apart.
You credit Dolly Madison with shaping the city of Washington, D.C., and making it a desirable place to live in. What did she do? Convince Michelle Richard to open a restaurant?
Well, the functional equivalent thereof. She, first of all, she came in 1801 as this pretty, vivacious, young wife of the Secretary of State, James Madison. And Thomas Jefferson was such a complicated creature. And he would have dinners one night for the Federalists, one night for the Republicans. He'd fit in modern Washington. And he didn't have a wife. And so occasionally when he had to entertain women, he'd ask Dolly Madison and her sisters to come. But she set up a whole separate power center at the Secretary of State's house, and everybody had to be there. And she was the person who could bring people together. And then when she became official First Lady, of course, the British invaded Washington. She came back a couple of days after the invasion. There'd been fire and then flood because there was a terrible storm. The city was wrecked, and it wasn't much of a city anyway. Everybody wanted to move the capital to Philadelphia, preferably, maybe New York, whatever. And she's the person who really worked hard to keep the capital in Philadelphia. I have some letters, actually, that I quoted in Ladies of Liberty between Abigail Adams and her son-in-law, who was in Congress, saying, "I guess it's all over for Washington now. No, it will never stay as the capital." But Dolly lobbied hard. And these women were all lobbyists. Some were actually paid lobbyists, but most were lobbying with the men that they knew well.
The Civil War really created a vacuum that women could take advantage of in the same way that we think of World War II as right. The Rosie the Riveter time. What were women doing during the Civil War?
Well, of course, it was similar to World War II, and that was one of the things that interested me so much when I started thinking about a Civil War book and what would I write. I started thinking about how World War II had changed the roles of women. And, of course, we've gotten familiar with Rosie the Riveter recently.
World War One, women did a lot of nursing, right. As Hemingway
right.
has
but,
revealed.
But so nursing didn't – women didn't start nursing until the Civil War. Mm-hmm. It was not women's work until the Civil War. And women just showed up in large numbers. And Dorothea Dix, who, by the way – was so powerful before the war even that the Senate had given her a little office in the Capitol from which to lobby for mental health hospitals and for the poor. So you already had some women who were active, but she then started nurses and nurses came in. You talk about Rosie the Riveter. Women worked in arsenals in tremendously dangerous situations. A huge arsenal explosion in Washington killed a couple of dozen women. Women came to work in the government just as they did in World War II. And that was actually somewhat amusing because they, just at the same time that the Congress approved the printing of greenbacks, paper money, to pay for the war, women started showing up to make a living. And the treasurer of the United States, General Skinner, said, "Well, I'm going to hire women for these jobs because the money would come off the press." It still does in these huge sheets. And they'd have to sit there and cut the bills out with scissors one by one. And he said, "Women are better with scissors than men are."
But didn't people see the irony in the fact that women were getting these jobs in Treasury and elsewhere, some very important jobs, and couldn't vote? In fact, had practically no power at all.
Well, they had no legal rights either. I mean, no political rights, but they also had no legal rights. A married woman could not own property. She was the property of her husband, which, by the way, had some interesting sort of reverberations in how they felt about slavery, because some of the Southern women really thought it wasn't very different from marriage, you know, that you sold yourself into marriage. So the fact that the women were doing all of this work without any rights was not lost on everyone, but it was just considered, well, we need them to do this, and they need to do it.
And during the war, Washington, D.C. became a refuge for escaped slaves. When they arrived in Washington, it was women who helped them in the transition.
Well, one woman who was particularly influential was Elizabeth Keckley, a former slave who was a very talented dressmaker, couturier, who had worked for some of the Southern women, particularly Verena Davis, the wife of Jefferson Davis. And then on the recommendation of those women, she started sewing for Mary Lincoln and became a really very close confidant of Mrs. Lincoln's. And
so she worked for the presidents of both sides.
That's right. Actually, there are a lot of similarities when you look at Verena Davis and Mary Lincoln's lives. But Elizabeth Keckley, having been a slave herself, started seeing these people arriving who had no wherewithal to do anything. They had been abused, but they had been fed and clothed and, you know, had not had to figure out any of that for themselves. And so she started an organization where she was able to get the women that she sewed for to make contributions. And so that was one of the first to deal with the slaves, at that point escaped slaves and then eventually freed slaves, freedmen. And it was women who did that. But women really did the social service activity from about the early 19th century on.
But they were doing other things as well, dangerous work like making munitions at arsenals. Some lost their lives as a result. Also, there's a woman, Anna Ella Carroll, who was an early, what word do we want to call it, propagandist?
She was a propagandist.
Spin doctor.
She was the media campaign, and she felt very strongly that her views were important. And she first worked as, ironically, for the Know Nothing Party. She was from this iconic Catholic family. The first bishop, John Carroll, was one of her relatives, but she was a know-nothing, an anti-Catholic
party. I've always loved
party.
That name for a party.
It is a great
Both
name.
Both parties now can call themselves right. a know-nothing party.
But she wrote propaganda that was considered very important during the war for the Union and was paid for it.
My guest is Cokie Roberts, in case you don't recognize that voice. Her latest book from Harper is called Capital Dames, The Civil War and the Women of Washington, 1848 to 1868. Is it true that that people came and then left because of the weather? Washington's weather doesn't seem all that terrible today.
Oh, people still complain about it a lot.
There's a lot of back and forth. The season was
a season that basically went from December till March. In even numbered years, and then in odd numbered years, there'd be an inauguration in March every 4 years, and then they'd go on for a couple more months. But they were not there in the summertime.
You've called your second chapter "Jesse Runs for President, mm-hmm. but Harriet Takes the White House and Mary Jane Reports, 1856-1858." Let's talk about Jesse first. Who's Jesse Benton Fremont?
Well, Jesse Benton's father, Thomas Hart Benton, was a very powerful senator from Missouri and very much part of the inner circle of the Andrew Jackson administration. He was in the Senate for 30 years. She then married John C. Fremont, a famous explorer, who then was one of the first senators from California. But, you know, you say that sort of, oh, all right, he was senator from California. Getting to California for Jesse Fremont was unbelievable. She had to sail down the Atlantic coast. She was alone with her six-year-old daughter. Go across the Isthmus of Panama, which took weeks because no ship was coming from San Francisco to collect them because everybody was looking for gold. And it was dangerous. It was filled with disease. It was bizarre. At one point, she was served a baked monkey, and she said it looked like nothing so much as a child, you know, a little fried child. And then up to San Francisco, which had 16 houses at the time, you know, it was very primitive. And then she is the senator's wife and is happy to be back in Washington. But then John C. Fremont was the first Republican nominee for president, new Republican Party.
Let's take a little break and we'll come back to that. My guest, as I said, is Cokie Roberts. Her latest book, Capital Dames, The Civil War and the Women of Washington, 1848 to 1868, published by Harper. And we're back with Cokie Roberts, who is, as you probably know, a political commentator for ABC News and NPR. She is also the author of a number of bestsellers. Her most recent book, sure to be a bestseller, is Capital Dames, The Civil War and the Women of Washington, 1848-1868. It is published by Harper's. Getting back to Fremont, Jesse's parents didn't want her to marry him.
Well, because he was totally unreliable. They turned out to be right. But she was a determined young woman, and she was also a very politically astute less young woman. And she was in the 1856 campaign. She was absolutely out there. There was no behind the scenes or pretending to not be influential. She was a force, and everybody talked about her as a force, and ran John Fremont and Jesse. Those were the vice presidential candidate was never seen.
There's a quotation from a Democratic newspaper on Fremont's run. Quote, inasmuch as black Republicans are making desperate efforts to elect Fremont upon the strength of his wife's, Jesse Benton's, virtues, abilities, patriotism, and popularity, we modestly suggest the following as an appropriate design for their ticket. For President John C. Fremont, husband of, and that's in very small right. type, and then big type, Jesse Benton. Now, her father worked against Fremont.
Yes, her father worked for Buchanan for president because he thought the Republican Party was just a regional party, and he was very keen to keep the country together.
Well, Buchanan turned out to be a disaster as a president. Do you think Fremont might have been a better president?
Probably not.
We had to wait for Lincoln in either case.
Right. I mean, you know, it's interesting, Leonard. I have written all these history books, and as much as I admire most of the men in them, I don't like most of them, except Abraham Lincoln, who is a really remarkably likable person.
You have problems with Mary Todd Lincoln as well.
Well, she's not easy to like. She was a tortured soul, and she I think did have mental illness issues, but he loved her and she loved him, and she did have political views that she was pushing him, similar to Eleanor Roosevelt, trying to push him faster in terms of abolition and all of that, and he knew that he had to take it as he took it.
Now, when the South seceded, a lot of women left Washington as well, and Anthony Trollope, the British writer who frequently visited the U.S. when he wasn't writing the Forsyth sagas, said at one point that society had been almost destroyed by the loss of the southern half of the usual sojourners in the city.
Well, the city was a southern city.
He said the city wasn't as much fun.
It wasn't as much fun. The city was a southern city, and the politicians from the south tended to be of families. So, you know, a father would be a politician, a son would be a politician. And so the women of the families got to know the city very well and really run the salons of the city. And they were delightful. I mean, reading their mail is really fun. And they put on nice entertainments and all of that. And then when they left, it was left to, as Trollope said, sort of stern New Englanders and coarse Westerners. And Mary Lincoln suffered from that because people thought she was one of those coarse Westerners, which wasn't really fair. She had been raised very similarly to many of the Southern women. But she was Abraham Lincoln's wife, and there was just no winning that one.
Well, she had some pretty sad things happened in her life before Abraham Lincoln died. She had lost two sons, Willie and Eddie, and she held seances so she could communicate with them.
Yeah, that was now again. That's very odd, and she claimed that she saw, you know, Willie at the foot of her bed and all of that. But seances were not uncommon in the era, and people did hold them all the time. There was one particular charlatan in Washington who was found out by a newspaper man, Noah Brooks, doing, you know, banging on a table or whatever. But, you know, the problem Mary Lincoln had was she did have tremendous sadness and loss, but everybody did. You're talking about a civil war where, in the end, more than 600,000 Americans lost their lives. So every
the most
mother,
terrible war up it, to that time.
Well, still the most terrible. Every mother was mourning.
even during the Civil War, you write that congressmen and their wives still had plenty of time to engage in scandalous behavior. What were some of the biggest scandals during the Civil War?
Well, one of the biggest, this one was leading up to the war, but this was Dan Sickles, who became a decorated Union general, was a member of Congress, and he had gone to England when Buchanan was ambassador to the court of St. James. Sickles was married to this nice young woman in New York. He was a congressman from New York later. And he went to London with a very well-known New York prostitute. And it was in all the newspapers, even though he had a wife and daughter. Finally, the wife and child come over. The prostitute is dispatched with. And then he gets elected to Congress. They go to Washington. And he's having a fairly public dalliance with a woman in Baltimore. But Teresa, his wife, takes up with Barton Key, the son of Francis Scott Key. And somebody writes Sickles a note to tell him about it. He would have never noticed. Somebody wrote him a note to tell him about it. So for his honor, he figured he had to shoot Key, which he did in broad daylight in front of the White House with Key not being armed. And he's brought up under murder charges. And his lawyer was Edwin Stanton, who later became Secretary of War. And Stanton thought up, for the first time ever, a very interesting defense argument of temporary insanity. And Dan Sickles got off on temporary insanity.
Did he stay in Congress?
Oh, yes. And then he became a Union general.
And nobody noticed the ironic situation here?
The women did. The women wrote about it to each other. They were horrified. They didn't like him, and they liked Key.
You've spent a lifetime in Washington, D.C. Do you recognize the women of the 19th
century?
Oh,
sure. Absolutely. One of the nice things about writing history is how recognizable women are, because, you know, we still do the same things. You know, you recognize cooking and raising children and entertaining and running a household. But also, they were very politically astute, and their political views are interesting to read, interspersed with all of the rest of it. Women's letters are so much better than men's letters. You know, they're frank and they're fresh and they're funny. And men's letters are pompous and poured over and edited. The women are, you know, just right. And
but they didn't have to delete them.
That's right. There were no secret servers. but they did say sometimes, though. Abigail Brooks Adams, Charles Francis Adams' wife, so therefore John Quincy Adams' daughter-in-law, did write to her son Henry Adams and say, if anybody saw these letters, it would be a scandal. And it would be. These letters have never been published before. And she did write, you know, that Buchanan was an old toad and that various members of their delegation were pigs. And so she had very strong views.
One thing that's also the same, I would imagine, is the sexism, as we have heard from people like Kristen Gillibrand. I guess some things never change.
Well, you know, even now with Hillary Clinton having announced yesterday, there's a body of data that shows that how she runs this campaign has got to be very, very careful. Because if you're too empathetic as a woman, people think you're too soft. And if you're not empathetic enough, people think you're cold and imperious. And so it's still a very tough act.
And then there are those chocolate chip cookies.
That's right.
Cokie Roberts is a political commentator for ABC News and NPR. She's won countless awards and in 2008 was named a living legend by the Library of Congress.
Living, living.
I said living legend. You're still alive. The latest book is Capital Dames, The Civil War and the Women of Washington, 1848 to 1868. It is published by Harper. Cokie, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
So nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
In Kate Mulgrew's 40-year career as an actress, the roles she has played have run the gamut from the dewy ingenue Mary Ryan in the soap opera Ryan's Hope to Red, the formidable Russian criminal who runs the prison kitchen with an iron hand in the Netflix series Orange is the New Black. In between, she spent 7 years as the first female captain of the Enterprise in Star Trek Voyager. Now, in her new memoir called Born with Teeth, she tells the stories behind the scenes. It's published by Little Brown. I'm very pleased that it brings Kate Mulgrew to our show today. Welcome.
I couldn't be happier to be here. How have you been?
I'm well. Oh, it's interesting that you don't tell the complete story here. You end it at a point where I almost wondered, is this going to be continued?
Yes, I know it begs that question, doesn't it? But no, in true Irish fashion, I left it where I felt it was most organically left.
I was a little nervous you might give me that drilling red stare, but you don't look anything like
I'm
red.
I'm beaming at you. Thank you very much.
I guess that's why they call it acting.
No, they call that makeup.
Did they make you chop off your hair for the part?
They did indeed, and shorter and shorter and shorter. Each time I reported to Jenji Cohen, she'd go this with her fingers, cut it shorter, until it was absolutely just nubs on the top of my head and a magenta called eggplant. It was horrifying. I just renounced then my vanity. I said goodbye to everything, and it was strangely completely liberating.
But then between shoots, you let it grow back.
Yes, but only so much.
How does it feel to get your first Emmy nomination at 60?
Strange. Strange and lovely, but the whole thing was bizarre to me. Yes, at 60, that's rather late in the day, isn't it?
Your beauty has defined your roles up to now. Has it been difficult to move into more character actor parts?
I want you to repeat that question. Staring into my eyes, I defy you.
The picture on the cover of this book is absolutely stunning.
It's stunning. It's vintage. It was taken by my darling brother, Joe. I was 19 years old, could not afford a headshot. He took me into Central Park, and that's the real deal. So,
well,
in
he
my
gave you a good headshot.
Yes, he did, yes. But it tells the tale.
You describe your family as totally Irish. What does that mean?
No, we are Irish in the way we think and the way we approach things. Certainly my parents were Irish in their stoicism, in their love of books, in their conversation, in their sense of humor, and in the way they raised 8 children and lost 2.
Your mother danced with President Kennedy at his inauguration?
They were great friends. She was his private secretary for a few years, and she grew up with the Kennedy clan. She met Jean Kennedy Smith when they went to Sacred Heart Convent together, and that was the beginning of that very rich and wonderful friendship.
But didn't stay politically connected after Kennedy?
Who, my mother?
Yeah.
Well, of course. I write it in the book, Yellow Dog Democrats, both of my parents.
No, I didn't mean that. I mean, there was a real connection to the Kennedys.
My mother was Jean Kennedy Smith's best friend until my mother died.
One of your first chapters is called Derby Grange. Is it Derby Darby?
It's Derby.
What was Derby Grange and why was it so important to you?
Derby Grange was the small, very modest estate my father bought. I'd say it was in 1950. I forgot the dates. 58. I was about 5 or 6 years old. He bought it on 40 acres of land in the countryside outside of Dubuque, Iowa. And that, as they say, has made all the difference.
Why?
Magical, removed. Dreams came true there. It was idyllic. There were secrets there. There were shadows there. Things came to pass there of which we do not speak.
Mm-hmm.
Miracles and deaths, marriages, love. It all happened.
Although you do reveal an awful lot in this book.
I do, indeed.
But mostly about yourself.
For someone who pretends to keep it so close to the vest, you got that right. I do, yes.
You mentioned losing 2 sisters. Was the first death, your sister Maggie, a crib death?
Yes, it was a SIDS death. But, of course, I held myself fully accountable for that.
Yeah, why?
Because if you read the book, I was 4. But I did feed her that, as I put, fatal bottle of ice-cold water. 4 for me is the age of moral reasoning. I was fully aware of her death, and I attributed it to myself.
You felt you killed her?
And that gesture. But that's what happens when you're little. You know that, Leonard. That's what happens in the imagination. And that's why the imagination is sort of shaped at that point.
How did your parents react?
What do you mean, to their death of their daughter?
Or to
they had
that you had played a role in her death?
They completely dismissed it. As I wrote in the chapter. I mean, she shooed me out the door to go and play.
Is it fair to say that your parents didn't spend a great deal of time being introspective or talking about large issues with their children?
No, that's not fair to say.
Okay.
They did indeed spend a great deal of time being introspective and philosophical and also quite amusing and very charming. It was a loquacious group of people. But did they indulge us? By no means and on no level. In fact, the whole thing was to get their attention as quickly and effectively as possible.
Where were you in the birth order?
In the divine sweet spot, my love. Number two, first girl. Wanted and needed.
When did you find out that your sister Tessie wasn't well?
How old was I? I must have been about 16 or 17. She was 12 when she got sick with the brain tumor, inoperable, and she was 14 when she died.
Had you already left home?
I had left home, yes, that summer. And it was at the end of that summer that she died.
And your father didn't want you to go home for the funeral?
No, he didn't. That's also so Irish. So typically my father. He wanted that done. That needed to be done quickly. There was nothing remotely sentimental in my family regarding death. It was to be fixed quickly.
My guest is Kate Mulgrew. She's written a memoir called Born with Teeth. An interesting title.
I was born with this little
set
of teeth. Yes, two on top and two on the bottom.
That's rare, isn't it?
It's very rare. And Shakespeare would call me a witch, I think. And so would many, many other people in my life, I'm afraid.
How did you get the idea that you'd like to be an actress? Was that something that your family would have thought was a good idea?
Well, I wanted to be a poet. I thought I was going to be a great poet. And I went to school and read my poems out loud, and my mother showed up. And she listened to them. And, of course, she had me read a poem called The White Cliffs by Alice Dewar Miller. This was my mother's idea. Romance based on an American woman and an Englishman, World War I. At the end of which, all of the nuns were crying. Of course, they'd never heard anything like this. And in the car going home, my mother said to me, "You can either be a mediocre poet or a great actor. What do you think you'd rather be, darling?" And that was it. The die was cast.
Well, you left home to attend NYU.
I did.
But what happened?
I studied with the great Stella Adler in conjunction with the program at NYU, and I dropped out. I was offered two roles, Mary Ryan on Ryan's Hope, and simultaneously Emily Webb in Our Town at the American Shakespeare Festival, directed by the eminent Michael Caine. And I went to Stella when I said, I know this is against the rules. I know I'm doing the wrong thing, but I have to say yes. And she looked me dead in the eye, and she said, "You're going to do what you're going to do, that's clear. But only the work will lift you up, and I fear that you will skate into Hollywood." And sure enough, Hollywood came a calling.
You worked on a film with Richard Burton very early in your career. How was he to act with? Was he as much of a charmer as he's been painted out to be?
He was absolutely marvelous to me.
But he was also an alcoholic, wasn't he?
Well, he was, I think he drank, yes, I know he drank, but... he liked who he liked, and he didn't like who he didn't like. And I think that given his own background, a Welshman, a Celt, a poet, a wonderful, brilliant actor, I think he was probably feeling some degree of sadness about his own life. So
What advice did he give you?
He told me to get the hell out of the business, to save my soul, that it wasn't fit for man or woman. And that as a young, innocent girl, I'd do myself a big favor to walk away from it. And, of course, I just thought, well, he's reflecting on his own life. And, of course, to a large measure, he was. I summarily ignored him, as we all know, and went ahead.
Well, you're still in the biz.
Yes.
Very shortly after the beginning of your professional career, you found out you were pregnant. Did you think about getting married?
Oh, as fleetingly as that bird that just went by the window. No, I was too young. It never would have lasted. I understood that. And although I think he would have stepped forward, the father, it was not even discussed.
The doctor who gave you the news assumed that you'd want an abortion. In the book, it seems as if that was never an option for you. Did you even consider it fleetingly?
Never.
Was your decision based on religious belief? Did you see it as pro-abortion people see it as a matter of choice?
I didn't think of any of those things. I saw it as essential to who I am. There was just no question. I was pregnant and I was going to have this baby. Yes, this was...
And how did your mother react?
She said, "Well, kitten, you've made a big mistake. And now you're going to have to step up to the big plate and give this child up for adoption."
Had you hoped that she would?
Well, that would have been a different memoir, and it would have been a different life. I asked my mother if she would help me, and I would provide some money. We'd get a nanny, and if she could help me raise the baby initially, and she said, "No, I absolutely can't do that. We're still in the throes of our grief about Tess. Your father wouldn't think of it, and now you have to do the right thing, the thing that is best for the baby and for you."
And you were told you could choose the adoptive parents.
I was told that, but that is not what came to pass. And that is probably just another a chapter in the long and very interesting Bible of Catholic Charities, right? Mm.
Yes, well, Cardinal Dolan plays a role in that. I don't know how much you want to talk about that.
Cardinal Cook.
Cook was, oh, yeah.
Cardinal Cook, yeah.
Who has been proposed for sainthood, hasn't he?
Has he? Yeah. I don't know why.
Maybe I'm wrong.
Why am I laughing? They're all proposed for sainthood later at some point or another. I could talk about it, but I would have to be very careful because this is sort of something I've agreed with my daughter that I won't discuss too much.
Although you reveal a whole bunch of things being raped as well here. But
yes.
Were the fans of the soap opera aware of your situation? I mean, they knew you. The baby had been written into the story.
If they were aware, they were incredibly kind. They were remarkably discreet, as was the press. Do you know, it wasn't leaked at all. So I think that there must have been a terrific sympathy. There must have been an understanding of what I was going through.
Or did they assume that you just simply were being padded as you got more and more
who knows? Progressive? Perhaps some did and some didn't. At any rate, I was not hurt by that at that time.
When you gave the baby up, did you imagine that you would be able to put it behind you?
No, I knew I wouldn't be able to. I knew that going in. I knew that the minute I found out I was pregnant. Are you kidding? I understood exactly what this was going to cost. I just didn't understand the size of it. When you're 20, 21, you don't know how things are going to settle with what seismic detonation it's going to go off. So immediately after it, I realized that I had to find her.
And you agreed to a closed adoption. It must have been painful to write some of this book. And up until now, your private life has remained private.
That's correct. Yes, it was painful. And up to now, my private life has remained private. But when you write a memoir and you write it with a pledge to be honest, then you have to step forward with that in mind.
The other shock was a brutal rape.
You can call it brutal. I don't think in terms of...
You were raped by a stranger.
Yes, a complete stranger. I was deeply impersonal. I was targeted, and I wrote it in that manner.
We don't have time to talk about the affairs of marriages, whatever, but a moment on Star Trek. Had you been a Star Trek fan?
I had not. I knew nothing about science fiction, and therefore it was just blown out of a cannon. I was just shot straight out of a cannon, and I'm glad I was. Otherwise, I'm not sure I would have been able to handle it.
What about your kids? You brought your two children, both boys of an appropriate age, to the premiere, and they behaved abominably.
Well, you could say an appropriate age, but I would argue what age is appropriate when you're staring at a huge screen watching your mother, who has been largely absent from the house because of this job. They were filled with all kinds of mixed feelings, foremost among them resentment, and they showed it to me.
They threw spitballs.
Spitballs at the screen, yes.
Have you ever gotten to see your child?
She's very, very much in my life and has been for 18 years. I found her, she found me, and it has been a wonderful, wonderful relationship.
Are you finished with Red?
With Red?
Yeah.
It's only just begun.
You're scaring the heck out of me.
Now they just announced season 4 today. We're all happy.
I'm glad you didn't bring me a sandwich.
Or a little chicken,
a little tail.
Perhaps.
Kate Mulgrew's book, memoir, Born with Teeth, is published by Little Brown. Thank you so much for being on
our
show.
My pleasure. You're terrific. Bye-bye.
Kehinde Wiley's monumental portraits of young African-American men using the poses and conventions of traditional European portraiture have created quite a stir in the art world, and now the first museum survey of his career has been mounted at the Brooklyn Museum. It not only includes some of his most well-known paintings, but also some newer work, portraits of women, stained glass windows, and bronze busts. Kehinde Wiley, A New Republic, will be on view at the Brooklyn Museum until May 24th, and I'm very pleased that has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
How does it feel to have a museum survey? This is different than a solo. You've had a solo show of your work at the tender age of, what, 37, 38?
38. It feels great. It's an opportunity in many ways to look back over the years and recognize a lot of those key changes in the work that have occurred. It also kind of makes me feel old. It's one of those things. It's coming at the age of 38 and allows you to at once feel as though the work has evolved and changed in many ways, but also comes at a point in which you kind of want to be able to step back a bit more.
Well, the way to resolve that is just not do as many as much work as you have in the past. You grew up in Los Angeles. At what age did you know you wanted to be an artist?
You know, I've been painting since I was 11 years old. My mom sent me to art school when I was a kid, and ever since then I've been.
But then you came east. You studied at Yale and did a residency at the Studio Museum in Harlem. Was that where you began doing the kind of large-scale portraits we now think of as your signature work?
It was indeed. In fact, it was in Harlem where I would leave my studio every day trying to get a sense of the city. I would go out into 125th Street and stop complete strangers in the streets, asking them if they wouldn't mind looking at photographs of my work and asking them if they wouldn't mind modeling for me. And most people, in fact, say no.
Did some of them think that you really something else was going on there?
I don't know. It's a tough thing. I've been doing this type of street casting not only here in New York, but increasingly all over the world. And you'll find that people in large cities, by and large, have a large city mentality when it comes to complete strangers stopping them in the streets.
We've learned that one of WNYC's employees, Darnell Jefferson, posed for one of your paintings.
That's right. In fact, it was a really great surprise to see Darnell this morning in the lobby. It's one of those things where, as the years go, and as I continue painting, you get a chance to see a good cross-section of New York and the different people's lives that you encounter.
You were given a major opportunity by Jeffrey Deitch, who helped out so many young artists when he had his Soho gallery. But let's talk a bit about the work. They're paintings of young black men in poses taken from classical paintings. How did you come up with the idea?
I love classical painting. I love 18th and 19th century British and French portraiture. I love the artifice of society portraiture, the artificiality that goes into all of that chest beating that you see there. As a child, I remember going to the Huntington Library and Gardens in Los Angeles and looking at paintings like Pinky and Blue Boy, looking at a lot of those society portraits and thinking, what's up with the lapdogs and the powdered wigs and the jewels? There was a sense
of... So you want to be the Joshua Reynolds of America?
Well, it wasn't about being a Joshua Reynolds. It was about interacting with all that status anxiety. You know, I was coming from South Central Los Angeles, not necessarily engaging with the social elite. This was a way of stepping into an alternate reality that existed centuries ago.
Was it also as simple as thinking that you weren't seeing portraits of people in museums who looked like the people you knew?
Decidedly so. I mean, there was something really amazing going to the Los Angeles County Museum of Art and encountering a Carrie James Marshall painting. One of my first times seeing a painting that large of young black men on view. It's pretty striking to be able to engage with someone who looks like you in a museum.
But why replace the subjects of these old European paintings with young black men rather than paint them in their own environment? And you could include dogs and whatever else the British and French painters included.
My investigation is one about history. It's about the dominance and the control of painting, the fact that painting functioned in many ways as a type of propaganda act. My work is, insofar as it critiques the past, it also embraces the material practice of painting historically. And what I really want to do is to at once wrap my arms around my true and abiding love for painting, but also step directly into that circle, contend with the language and the look and feel of actual paintings from the past.
Because if you don't have the painting chops, these things are not very effective.
I think so. I mean,
but by putting these young men into these paintings, were you making a political statement, a gesture of conferring power on many people who aren't always, or who can often be considered powerless?
Everything's political in art, and I could be painting a bowl of fruit, and that would be politicized. There has to be a way in which we look at black bodies in public space in a politicized way, and my responsibility is to point to it in a way that says something positive or negative. I embrace both the beautiful and terrible past, but I also want to be able to point to something redeeming.
So when you go out street casting, as you called it, does that mean that you you just see somebody who you think might be interesting? Why that person, not the next person?
You know what, Leonard? You know it when you see it. There really is no one type. There's a state of grace. There's a sense of self-possession that people have. It's really one of the best things that can happen in my practice, because you know from that very moment that this is going to be an amazing painting. And it's that moment of chance that gives rise to this entire project. So much of the portraiture of the past had to do with people who had the means and wherewithal to create these large statements of their position in life. This is about someone minding their own business, trying to get to the train, and the next thing you know, they're hanging in the Brooklyn Museum.
There's a collaborative aspect as well. Don't you have them look through art history books and choose the pose that they would want to strike or the painting that they'd like to be in?
And this gets to the point of ceding a bit of power. As the artist, you have to be able to have this collaborative conversation with the sitter. Traditionally, artists have always had the role of deciding everything within those paintings, and I think it's really interesting to be able to have features of the model's taste, their choice. Sure, all of these art history books are mine when we're in the studio, but they're going through and deciding, this is what I respond to. This is a picture of me in the world.
Now, those artists of the past didn't have photography to help them. Do you take pictures, or do you use the old-fashioned method of having them sit there for day upon day?
Well, no one has the time for sit for a painting these days, but what I do is I really do make painting in the 21st century. It starts with photography. I'll then go into Photoshop and heighten and diminish colors. Elements that were there are certainly there. I mean, every one of the people that I meet that day are wearing the clothes, the street clothes that they had on that day. But there are moments where I like to toy with the viewer. So there will be, for every painting that is true to that narrative, one picture that's been completely manufactured, a picture in which there has no relationship to the actual. So for every show in which all of the models are coming from Nigeria, let's say, there will be one kid from Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. You as the viewer never really know if you're getting something else.
Kehinde Wiley's survey of his work, A New Republic, is at the Brooklyn Museum. It'll be there until May 24th. These portraits often have elaborately patterned flowered backgrounds, like kind of like wallpaper.
Mm.
Why did you want to use those kinds of patterns rather than replicate the backgrounds of the original paintings?
Well, the original paintings had landscapes in which the landed gentry would often have their wives, children, cattle, homes, all in equal measure behind them as possessions. I wanted to narrow down that field and break it into these simple colored swatches in which the background is populated by decoration. The decorative field becomes that sort of irrational decorative space. Women's work, this toil of keeping the hands busy so that the mind doesn't go into its nether regions. I also wanted to think about the background as being in competition with the sitter. You always notice in the paintings that the background is sort of fighting for the foreground.
You have tendrils sometimes reaching out around the front of your subjects.
That's right. And the question then becomes, who deserves to be here? The painting in itself functions as a stand-in between the conversation that's going on about deserving to be present.
The titles of these paintings are usually the titles of the works that they're based on, like Napoleon leading the army over the Alps or Saint Andrew. You don't use the names of the subjects.
Oftentimes, I will use the names of the subjects. In fact,
the one exception is Portrait of King Philip II, Michael Jackson.
That's a really interesting story, where Michael Jackson was actually at the Brooklyn Museum looking at one of my paintings shortly before his death. And we began a conversation around how we can actually discuss the history of art, but also how this history of art could be at service towards picturing celebrity. That's one of the reasons I think that the armor comes into play so heavily there.
Did he ask you to do a painting that included him? You have him pick it?
Yeah. No, in fact, we had this relay conversation back and forth, generally looking at the ways in which equestrian portraiture evolved. Michael was really well informed about the history of painting. I remember him really convincing me that it was better to look at later Rubens than earlier.
Do they ever pick a picture that you don't think you should be doing?
You know, honestly, it's all open. There's thousands and thousands of pictures to choose from, and it's up to them to choose how they want to be seen.
The young men are generally dressed in T-shirts, sports jerseys, jeans, or shorts. Sometimes you can even see if they prefer Hanes or Fruit of the Loom. But when you decided to do a series of portraits of women called An Economy of Grace, you had gowns made for them by the House of Givenchy.
That's true. I wanted to look at beauty. I wanted to look at clothing as armor, clothing as both saying something but also hiding something. The history of painting and women painting specifically has much more to do with the male gaze. Women is being displayed oftentimes with their heads turned so that the male eye can draw itself across their bodies, that absolute reveal. In my work, I wanted to at once look at that history, but also turn it in on itself, to be able to turn up the volume on the aesthetic aspects of female presence in painting. What happens when beauty itself becomes indicted? You turn it up so much that you have to call in the couture houses. You have to call in Riccardo Tisci to create something that almost falls in under its own weight. The ridiculousness of the type of pomp was something that I wanted to point to.
Are people ever surprised when they see Judith and Holofernes?
I think so. I think it's one of those more violent paintings, although mine is quite understated if you look at some of the...
But it has a racial component to it.
Decidedly so. All of my paintings have a racial component. This one, I think, differs in the fact that there is a white female head that's been eviscerated.
You have set up studios in China and Senegal as well as your studio in Brooklyn?
That's correct.
Why? I know your father, what I've read, you never knew your father growing up. He went back to Africa before you were born, which makes you similar in some ways to the President of the United States.
People say that sometimes, but I think the president has a decidedly more complex story. Mine is that my father came to the United States back in the 1970s, where he studied with my mom, and their relationship ended. He returns to Nigeria. I go on to study art, fall in love in China, open a studio there, discover Africa again, open a studio there, have a studio here in New York as well. There's something really great about being able to wander the world, using that travel to inform your life, inform your sensibilities. There, consequently, is also an opportunity to open those doors. This year, we're expanding the studio in Senegal to include 3 artist-in-residence studios, in which we'll be able to have artists from the United States and Europe, increasingly all over the world, come through and see how West Africa can inform their voices.
You also use a number of assistants.
That's correct.
In the manner of Rubens and other painters of the past. But when the assistants come from different parts of the world, do they bring different sensibilities?
I think so. I think that there's decidedly something to be said about the detail that goes into the flowers. In order to understand my process, you have to understand that I stand on the shoulders of a long line of artists who worked with assistants. And what I do is I paint all of the portraits, and my assistants paint those decorative fields, all of those repeating patterns behind the models. And I find that if you're dealing with different cultural inflections, you'll find West African patterns decidedly easier to paint in West Africa, for example.
The show also includes some of your more recent works, including stained glass windows. Are they made from your paintings?
They are not. The stained glass actually starts much in the same way that the paintings do, which is that we go out casting and then allow Photoshop to come to the picture. So now I'm dealing with the entire history of stained glass. But now, as opposed to drawing it out, I'm allowed that many more options on the computer where I can now begin to visualize a full range of possibilities for stained glass.
And you have some smaller portraits, paintings done in the form of religious icons or altarpieces and bronze sculptures. Working in sculpture is very different than working in painting. And
that's right.
A lot of people don't feel that you should mix the two.
Well, I've always been concerned with being able to create a full vocabulary when it comes to my work. I always wanted to be able to take elements of the past as pieces of the alphabet, putting together sentences. And I think that sculpture and stained glass play a vital role in that. It's also having to do with autobiography. When I was 12 years old, my mother sent me off to Russia to study painting in the forest outside of Leningrad in a small town called Lucevo. And when we took our day trips into then Leningrad, I discovered stained glass. I discovered small gilded gold icon paintings. And in many ways, what you see at the Brooklyn Museum is, sure, an embrace of our history, but also an embrace of a personal story.
The show will be on view at the Brooklyn Museum until May 24th. Will it be traveling to other venues after that?
It will. It's on a tour for the next 5 years, and it'll be at 8 different institutions throughout the United States.
So you had to give up your babies for a while.
Well, that's true. There'll be more babies.
Gahinder Wali will be speaking with DJ Spooky this Thursday at 7 o'clock at the Brooklyn Museum. For ticket information, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. The show, which is called Gahinder Wali, A New Republic, is at the museum until May 24th. And my great thanks to Gahinder Wali for being on our show today.
Thank you, Leonard.
The sound of a theremin is most commonly associated with the arrival of a flying saucer in a movie or a creeping monster, hypnosis, other signs of paranormal activity. Not the sort of thing we're listening to right now, a composition by Rob Schwimmer called Waltz for Clara. But theremin virtuosos Dorit Kreisler and Rob Schwimmer demonstrate that the instrument is actually expressive, versatile, and pretty much totally misunderstood in their performances. And then on the 16th at Joe's Pub. The 16th is
17th.
What? The 17th.
Okay.
Tomorrow.
So that's tomorrow. Yeah. Dorit and Rob, along with Scott Robinson, will perform solo works, collaborations, and a rendition of Bernard Herrmann's movie score for The Day the Earth Stood Still. Both Dorit and Rob are members of the New York Theremin Society. I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Great to be here.
Rob, you brought a theremin to the studio today. I'm looking at a box that has a bunch of knobs, and I'm seeing is an antenna. Is there an antenna there?
Yes. Well, pitch antenna, and this is a volume loop on this side.
So you have one on each side.
Yes.
Can you demonstrate how that works? Do you have to? Do they just automatically adjust to what you're doing?
They fight you all the way, but in a very pleasant way, hopefully. Let me show you, and Dorit can tell you what's happening while I move around, all right?
You're playing with electromagnetic waves, aren't you, Dorit?
Yes. So electromagnetic fields are being created, one around the pitch antenna and one that you can hear right now, and one for the volume rod. The system is called heterodyning system. So the closer your hand goes to the pitch antenna, the higher the pitch. And the volume, it's exactly the opposite way. When you have your hand on the volume rod, it's quiet, and the further you lift it up. So you have one vertical and one horizontal electromagnetic field.
I'd imagine it's difficult. Right now we're hearing Somewhere Over the Rainbow, and Rob's hands are just up in the air, just moving around on the air. It looks like, it seems to me, it might even be more difficult to stay in tune than it is on a string bass, which has no frets.
It's If you can think of a fretless bass that has no strings or no neck, mm-hmm. it's a little bit more like that. Yeah, I mean, it's constant adjustment, you know, fixing, you know, constant adjustment because you're just moving in the air. You have to hear where your note is and fix your hand.
And the right hand has to know what the left hand is doing at all times.
I mean, personally, I don't think a theremin is harder to play than, let's say, a violin. But before, because the instrument is so much less established in the pantheon of instruments, I guess less people put in the effort of really practicing it with the same fervor to get to the same level.
Well, how many hours do you need to actually get to that point?
I think you just have to approach it like any other instrument and do your scales.
Well, in the case of the violin, and there, since you bring that up, an important part of whether you're a good violinist or not is your tone.
Yes.
But can you control tone here, or is pretty much the instrument that controls the tone?
I think it's more you than the instrument that really gives the color to the tone. It's really in the volume, and so it is the slightest motion of your body. And the theremin is really one of the few instruments that I think translates the personality of its player really well, because it is your body being the conductor.
But yeah. In the case of the violin, you're touching the instrument at all times. Here you're not touching the instrument. You can also feel the vibrations of the wood, and each violin is different because it is made out of a different piece of wood. Here you have an instrument that is made, it's metal box with stuff inside.
It's a crazy thing, you know. I mean, you just imagine, though, I'm going off to the left slightly, but the moment that theremin thought, ooh, we can make an instrument out of electricity, you know, this mm-hmm. lightning bolt striking, going, oh, mm-hmm. we can make an instrument out of electricity. So, okay, you know, there's no, wood from Cremona here or anything like that. But
there's no Stradivarius type.
Well, there are considered, the ones that he made, like in the, you know, in the 20s and the 30s, the very old ones with tubes, you know, are super highly sought after.
Are they better, or just simply is it the historic aspect that makes them valuable?
Every instrument, every theremin sounds completely different, and there is high and low quality, and it very much depends, I think, on the capacity of especially the volume rod. And depending on that, I mean, I would recognize each theremin model on its sound.
And the tone is different from, yeah. And it is happy in a, I mean, it's happy in an electronic environment. I could show you something, for example.
There's a lot of electricity here, microphones and all of that.
Well,
does that affect it?
Everything affects it. It's a finicky but fabulous thing. So I brought a pedal that you can hear. It'll change the sound just for an example.
It's like a wah-wah pedal?
Well, it's, here's the regular. So straight sound.
You can send the theremin through any kind of effect pedal. You can loop it. There's a lot of different stuff you can do with it.
It often sounds like a human voice, mm-hmm. and I assume that's part of the appeal, some things that you can do with it that you probably couldn't do with any other instrument. But when Leon Theremin patented the device in 1928, what was the response at the time? Were people, did they think, wow, this is great, or did they think this is too weird to even consider?
Well, I think they tried to promote it as a house instrument, as easy playable as the home organ, and they very quickly found out that, you know, it just wasn't so. It was expensive for its time, and it was hard to play.
And it came out right before the stock market crash, which didn't help anything. But they advertised it as, now anyone can play music with mm-hmm. just a wave of your hand, which is certainly not the case.
Well, we talked about how it's like a fretless bass in some ways. Are you playing by ear, in effect? I mean,
that's
just have to know where your hand is, has to be at all times?
That is all you have. Mm-hmm. That's all you have.
How do you compose for an instrument like that?
Yeah, well, it depends upon your player. I mean, if your player is good, you can compose it pretty much like any other instrument.
Have any major composers composed for the theremin?
Messiaen?
Messiaen was Hans Martineau. But
Messiaen was just messing around.
The Hollywood, if you're going to consider, you know, someone like Miklos Rosa or Bernard Herrmann as major composers. Now, I know some people have been writing pieces, you know, modern classical composers that are including theremin.
It would urgently need more contemporary composers actually knowing what the theremin is capable of and writing for it.
I thought Shostakovich wrote something for it.
It was one of the earliest Russian films. Hmm. I think it translates to Alone, but in Russian, I forget what it was. But yeah, he didn't really, honestly, having heard it, I don't think he really knew quite what he was dealing with there. Hmm. But
he didn't understand the possibilities.
I don't know if the possibilities were really understood at that point. You know, it was pretty early on in the, you know, I mean, most instruments have a long, you know, period, you know, through they discover what can be done and, you know, where we are in the evolution of the instrument. So early on, it's rough with the new instrument.
But I suspect from what you just said and from what I know that it's been most popular with people composing for the movies.
It works well for the movies. It's very well, it has a historic tradition. That's when it was first applied in popular music. And I think because it's one of the very few, well, it's the only electronic instrument that actually has a very emotional, if not to say dramatic, quality, which applies itself to the, you know, creating moods and drama for cinematic soundscapes.
Plus, so you'll be performing music from The Day the Earth Stood Still tomorrow at Joe's Pub.
Yeah, we're going to do it. We're going to do
it. Is that one of the great pieces?
Oh, yeah. It's one of the great sci-fi pieces, and we're going to do it as a trio, which the thereminists almost never do. We're going to do that, and that's going to go into Carlotta's Portrait by Bernard Herrmann from Vertigo.
So Herrmann, did he compose for the theremin?
Yes.
Well, yes, in The Day the Earth Stood Still, but we are stealing the one from Vertigo that did not have theremin.
And we have a video on our show page of you playing that music from Vertigo. The Led Zeppelin also used the theremin on a few tracks, I understand. But I always thought that the instrument on the Beach Boys' Good Vibrations was a theremin. Is that true?
They actually were using their finger on a slider. What was it called?
The guy's name was Paul Tanner.
Right.
And, they were having trouble, you know, having it be in tune enough. I spoke to Al Jardine of the Beach Boys about this. And he said, he wasn't there when they actually recorded it. But Paul Tanner made this instrument which kind of imitated the theremin and sort of sounded like it. And that's what they wound up using.
They just had markings on the slider so they knew exactly where to put the finger position.
Now, Rob, you've worked with Willie Nelson, Stevie Wonder, Chaka Khan, toured with Simon and Garfunkel. What would Willie Nelson want you to do? Can you duplicate slide guitar?
Well, no.
Could you give us a demonstration?
No. I'm a keyboard player. So a lot of these things I'm playing keyboards on. So I wasn't playing theremin with Willie Nelson. But I did play theremin.
I was getting worried.
Well, yeah, should be.
He can't be weird.
Yeah. So still, yeah. No. But I played with Simon and Garfunkel. I played the instrumental from The Boxer, you know, the da, 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 da. So I played that on theremin.
Can you show us? I'm sorry, it's just we have this instrument set up here, and I feel we should be playing it a bit more. If you can do that, then Simon doesn't need Garfunkel anymore to do the high parts. Is it mostly in that range? How wide a range?
It has up to five octaves.
Yeah.
So yeah, it has a wide range.
I often associate theremins with big boxes. Has the technology advanced since the 20s? Yeah. Are they getting smaller?
Well, actually, there's a new instrument by Moog Music called the Theremini. And it actually, it goes beyond the basic technology of a theremin. And that one, as that you can use the mechanism of how to generate the sound by not touching anything, but you can trigger all these presets. And that one is built very small and light and solid.
Well, you just changed the complete quality of the sound by you turned a button, a knob there?
Well, I just tuned it down so we could hear the, you know, the low range. I mean, it goes all the way down to where it breaks up into beats.
This is called calibration. You actually can set the size of your electromagnetic field and how many octaves the range you want to have when you play.
We go. Let's play a little bit of something that you have performed, Dorit, and then I want to thank you all. You'll be tomorrow night at Joe's Pub performing on the theremin with one of your other collaborators, Dorit Kreisler and Rob Schwimmer. Thank you both so much for being on our show. Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.